call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. Today's Sunday, the first day of May, 2005. It's now about 4:52 p.m. We have Senator Guest, Senator Terrio, Senator Huggins, myself, Senator Seekins, and Senator French present. All members are present. We'll start today's calendar with Senate Bill 125. And it looks to me like we have a new working draft being / I or India. And the chair looking for a motion to adopt this as our working document.
Mr. Chair, I move that we substitute for Senate Bill 125.
Aye, India.
India? I don't have India.
Don't have India? We'll get you in India, and I'll object to the motion until such time as we can step through the changes that have been made. And if you'll introduce yourself to the record, we'll start with the changes that have been made.
I'll be happy to. For the record, again, my name is Virginia Stankus. I'm with the Division of Public Health. My director, I think, is on his way from the grocery store to the nearest telephone to also participate. So if he calls in, I'm sure he'll be happy to step in. I also have...
If he calls in, that's Dr. Monzacher. I think he's...
Correct.
I think I show him on the... Is he on?
He shows on there, but he's actually not.
Not there yet. As soon as he is,
will it? Coming now.
Okay. And Stacey Crayley, also from Department of Law, is able to testify. Right. The version, again, you mentioned before you is version I, and there are a series of some technical amendments and some amendments that have been proposed. The first amendment was on, and I can walk you through on page 4, line 14, was a conforming amendment basically to, at the recommendation of Ledge Legal, that was adopted. That's the new section 6 that you can reference there.
So this whole section was added?
That's correct.
Okay.
And the issue there was, if my understanding is correct from the lawyers, is when this bill, which is now to license entities in lieu of individuals, and that was the conforming language that we're using throughout, this language was put in to facilitate that compliance. So that's the conforming amendment piece, as I understand it.
Okay. We have before us then an amendment that's dated 4-2805 in the upper right-hand corner. And on this CS, that would be amendment number 1. And the chair will move the amendment and then object to the amendment for purposes of discussion. Go ahead.
Senator Seekins, again, I think if you note it, with the exception, I think, of one, every number on these amendments says conforming technical amendment. And all of these, again, were a matter of definitions and compliance and consistency throughout the bill. I'll be happy to walk you through each of these. Again, Stacey Crayley from Department of Law and both Dr. Monsager are on the phone also.
Let's just go through them and see what they do.
If I may, I'd like to ask Stacey Crayley to talk about the, again, since this is the legal world.
Ms. Crayley, are you there?
I'm here. Thank you. This is Stacey Crayley from the Department of Law. And as Virginia Stonkus has mentioned, the amendments that are being proposed and discussed right now are, as you know, this is a lengthy bill with a lot of conforming amendments and different things. And as we've looked at it, we just... You know, hopefully could have caught them all at this point. So for the committee's discussion purposes, I'll walk through these amendments with you, and if you have any questions, just let me know. The first amendment, page 4, line 15 through page 5, line 28, which is section 6. You'll notice now we are deleting that section, which Virginia, Ms. Donkis, and you just went through and made an amendment on the previous version. What had happened is, as we were working through this and Ledge Legal took a look at this, they noted that we had repealed a section but left one section in, section 6, and then what would be section, I think, 44 of the bill. I misunderstood, and I apologize to the committee for the confusion, but I misunderstood their question when it was posed to us last week. And I made a mistake. And so this is correcting my misunderstanding and my mistake. And that section needs to be deleted because we're no longer licensing individuals, we're licensing entities.
Okay.
So that fixes, and that would also, I think, correspond with, I think, Amendment 9 of this packet. Amendment 2, page 8, line 15 through page line 30.
Say, Stacy, if we could just call these revision 2s because it's amendment number 1.
Oh, I'm sure.
Thank you. Just for the record, so that no one gets confused as they read this down the line.
I appreciate. This is in addition to the this is the conforming edit with respect to the change on page 9. That from alleged legal review to ensure that we are properly identifying the change under under that paragraph.
Okay,
Mr. Chairman.
Senator French.
Thank you, Stacy. Both of these amendments are having the effect of taking out the change to a license issued to a child care facility. Is that going to be relocated, or what's happening to both of those changes?
No, it goes back to the, through the chair, Senator French, the amendment goes back to my misunderstanding from the legal review, which was that we are no longer licensing individuals, but we're licensing entities. And so this particular statute identifies the type of 2527, I'm not sure what that specific statute deals with, but as you can tell, you deal with the what would be an individual property right, and we're no longer licensing individuals, but an entity. And so they won't be recodified or moved somewhere else. They're actually being repealed in total.
Okay.
Okay.
And then the number 3 and number 4 on your list, as you recall in our previous discussion, we had indicated a provider desire to include Medicaid fraud as an abuse, an inclusion on the abuse registry. Well, we felt that if we were going to include it on the abuse registry, that if somebody was actually prosecuted for Medicaid fraud, we would want that to be part of the criminal background check as well. So that's a conforming amendment to the criminal background check to make it consistent with the abuse registry.
Chairman. Smith, Senator French.
Stacy, on page 13, what I have in front of me now reads, the department may not issue or renew a license or certification for an entity if an individual is applying for a license renewal certification or certification renewal for the entity, and that individual has been found by a court agency, this or another court, to be neglected, abused, exploited a child. Can you just kind of walk me through how that is it the entity may not have someone to make this application, the person can't make the application, the person can't be part of a group that it's just not clear to me how does this work?
Through the chair, Senator French, the premise of how we envision this working, and of course it'll be further developed through a regulatory process similar to what's already done for assisted living homes. But the premise is that the entity would be the licensed structure, and then with respect to the hiring decisions, then the entity would submit a name and a fingerprint card for a criminal background check for an individual to see whether or not they were barred from employment either under a mandatory barrier crime list or a permissive barrier crime list. Does that answer your question?
I guess it's just a little unclear to me. It sounds like the entity can't have any person with a criminal history involving the items you mentioned working for the entity or applying for a license for the entity.
To me, it looks like that this individual cannot own an entity or be an officer, director, partner, member, or principal of a business organization that owns an entity if any of these things are there.
I got that from above, but it's just not clear how the license, how that operates with this licensing statute.
Through the chair, Senator French, the idea is that the barrier, and this is very similar to what is currently done with the assisted living home statutes, is which, and the foster care, child care placement statutes, where the employment or somebody, if you have somebody working with you or residing in your home who has regular contact with an individual, must submit to a criminal background check, and that criminal background check will show, if it shows a conviction for a certain list of crimes, then you can have nothing, you can't be employed as an employee or an owner or have any sort of function within the entity. There's another list or a less rigorous list, which would be what we call permissive crimes, where there would be the potential that if you were, you know, 20 years old and you got into a bar fight in college and you're now 35 and you've not had any trouble since that time, but you had an assault charge on your record from college, then you would still be able to have a part in a licensed entity, which would allow you to participate. And the basic structure of what we've envisioned is the nuts and bolts of this will be dealt with through the regulations, which is currently how we do things for the assisted living homes, and it seems to work pretty well.
It seems clumsily drafted, but I'm sure you guys will work it out in real life.
Oh.
Thank you.
I don't mean to be as I read it, I have difficulty with it, but I can see it's not something we're going to resolve, and I think the idea is sound behind it.
Okay, go ahead, Stacy.
The fifth bullet on your list, page 17, following line 26. Again, as we were drafting the initial version of this bill, if you went back and looked at what was proposed through the governor, the immunity, the abuse registry, and the criminal background history check were originally in the new sections of the bill, 4732. And as we thought further about the process, we discovered that there were a lot, it made more sense to have it be a standalone statute than tie it solely to the licensing provision. So we amended the version and created a standalone provision. But when we did that, we neglected to remove the immunity provision for the criminal background check with the criminal background check statute. And if you look on page 34 of the I version, and it starts on line 9 through line 15, that is what we're proposing to move to page 17, which is just that an entity that obtains information about an employee under the criminal background check under 4705.310 would have a level of immunity for using that information and making employment decisions. And so there's a corresponding amendment which deletes it from page 34 but moves it to page 17.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, may I ask a question?
Senator Guess.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you explain two things? One, it says may use that information only as provided in the regulation. I'm guessing that one of the things that's going to be in regulation is that they can use this information to deny employment. But if you could just verify that I'm reading that correctly, and then can you tell me legally what reasonably relies means?
Through the chair, Senator Guess, in response to your first question, you are reading that correctly. In response to your second question, I think the reasonable reliance issue is that if an employee presents a background check, a fingerprint card, and they run that through the FBI and the state process to determine whether or not there's a criminal charge on there, and they review that information and have access to that information and make a decision upon that, then decide not to employ somebody because they either meet a barrier crime or have a charge on their record that would preclude employment by the permissive standards, then the individual could not seek, you know, file suit against the employer for relying upon that information and making the employment decision.
But
it would entail the employer having to go through the process to get the information and rely upon that in making a decision, not just assuming there was something on the record.
Senator Guest?
Thank you. And if something's on their background check that wouldn't have them excluded from the licensure and all the other things in the provision, could that be a reason? Do they have a right for not employing that person because of something that's not related but that they just don't like on their background check?
Through the chair, Senator Guest, I would presume that an employment decision would be left up to the employer, and that there was something on the background check that was not necessarily a bar to employment, that there's a whole other host of employment issues and decisions that, you know, small businesses and large businesses make when they decide who to hire. So that's not what's envisioned here, but they could look at that, and there may be something on the record which wouldn't preclude employment, but they may still not to decide not to hire. But this would only deal with if the decision not to employ was based upon a criminal information received in response to a criminal background check. That's what this immunity would attach to.
But
sorry, I guess go ahead.
Thank you. But if maybe I'll ask it this way. Is there anything that would come up in a criminal background check that would not be a reason for them under statute to hire this person? Could they fall under immunity? I guess I'm worried because this is kind of open immunity, and could there be something that came up that where they would be licensed, they could be licensed under this statute, but an employer could use that information not to hire the person, and then we're immunizing against that. Does that make sense, Stacey?
It does, through the chair, Senator Guest. But I think that the distinction between your question and is that because let's say there's a charge of a very low level misdemeanor that isn't listed as a permissive, you know, not a barrier crime, but what I call a permissive crime. And so let's say it happened 15 years ago, but it's not even on the list. If the decision not to employ was based upon something that was not listed through the regulatory process, and I'll again note that we've kind of done a very, thorough job in identifying those types of crimes through the assisted living home regulations that are currently in effect right now, then that wouldn't, you couldn't use that as a basis for denying employment.
Let me see.
There's going to be the barrier crime, there's going to be these permissive crimes, and the other reasons for not hiring somebody would have to be outside of that sphere.
Let me ask you a question. If I, as a potential employer, ask for a criminal history check, do I get to see everything on that person's criminal history, or do I only see those things which would act as a barrier to hiring them under this statute?
Mr. Chairman, you would see everything on their background check. Assuming that that's what, I mean, you would see everything.
And a criminal history background check generally would be public information that I could find anyhow?
Not, Mr. Chairman, maybe not as readily as this process would envision, but yes, it is public.
So,
and I would note that you wouldn't get any juvenile offenses.
Correct.
It would just be adult offenses. Yeah, all of this information, if you wanted to go down to the clerk's office and put somebody's name in and call through the records, you could figure this all out on your own. This would just be a much more efficient process.
So, in effect, what I'm basically saying is here, there's no excuse now not to request it. In other words, we're putting an onus on the employer to have gone through the check, which was reasonably available to them in the first place. So if they wanted to preclude someone from being hired, they could probably find that information all by themselves in the first place.
That's correct.
So I understand what your question is there, Senator Guest, and probably we're still an at-will hiring state and a probationary hiring state. I think that in this case, we're just the bill is just saying we have to check their criminal history to know before we hire them if there are any barrier convictions. It's kind of a And then if we do, that we're immunized for refusing to hire them because of what's on their criminal background check, what we find there.
Mr. Chair, I guess it's that immunity that I'm slightly concerned with, and especially how the second sentence is written. If there's something that wasn't a barrier crime, and I'll just bring up an example of a constituent, and I think I brought up this constituent early. She was being sexually assaulted. She took a crowbar to the person. She ended up being arrested, had it dismissed, and there was a lot of confusion. In the end, it all got sorted out, went for a child care license, was denied, went through the permissive process. I mean, at least there was this other process. The other process worked. But are we giving an employer, let's say, the ability to look at that background check, say, okay, that doesn't fall under, or there's this other process, but I don't really like that this woman put herself in this situation, therefore I can deny her employment and I am immune from liability based on that decision. So she wouldn't have the right then to, let's say, go to the Human Rights Commission or another one to say, I don't think I was treated fairly.
That would be a real stretch that I don't think would be upheld, because I don't think you can legally hold someone responsible for a crime for which they were not charged or for which they were not convicted. But,
and I was just wondering on this, and maybe you or someone else on the committee could tell me, it just seems this second sentence says, regardless of if it's a barrier crime or anything else, they're immune from using anything on that criminal history. We're giving them immunity for anything on that criminal history. Am I reading that correct? Because what Stacy is saying is we're giving them immunity for the barrier crimes or for things that I totally agree with, that are in the statute where they couldn't get a license. But when I read this, it seems to say, or maybe I'm just totally missing it, that they can use, we're giving them immunity to use anything in their criminal history.
I don't think so, Senator Guest. Maybe I'm wrong. But they may use that information only as provided in regulations adopted by the department here.
However,
if that NTR reasonably relies on that information, the information that could be, the information that the same one that would be used, only as provided in regulations adopted. So that information, I don't think would necessarily say all information on the criminal history record, but they only may use that information that is provided in regulations adopted, and if they rely on that information that would be used as adopted under these regulations, then I think they have some immunity. If they were to use other things within the report, I'm not sure we're giving them that immunity. Maybe I'm wrong.
Mr. Chairman, again, I would agree with your assessment, and maybe I didn't say it as clearly as you did, but I think there are sufficient sideboards in here to ensure that the immunity that is being provided addresses only the use of the information from the criminal background check. And we do envision having a process whereby the example that Senator Guest gave with respect to a constituent, that individual would have the ability to either show that the dismissal was, that she wasn't acting in self-defense and that it was not, she shouldn't be barred mandatorily or permissively from receiving a license. And we want to envision having these types of processes available so that those individuals who want to provide these services are able to, as long as they meet these qualifications.
Senator French?
The regulation process should hopefully address all these issues.
Senator French?
That's what we're envisioning.
Right. Senator French?
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I think that Stacy is using it in one sense, and you, Mr. Chairman, are using it in another, and I think your sense is one that we should try to nail down a little bit more tightly in that second sentence. I think if the second sentence said something like, however, if that entity or individual service provider reasonably relies on that information only in the manner provided in regulations adopted by the department, and denies employment for an individual selected for hire as an employee, the entity is not liable for any action. If you use the information as the regulations provide, that's fine. But what Senator Guest is saying is that they could misread that information. They could mistake a charge for a conviction, and there's a big difference. Or they could decide that DWI 15 years ago is suddenly a barrier crime through an error in thinking and escape any liability for making a really dumb decision or a bad decision based on their interpretation of someone's criminal history. Those documents are sometimes tricky to read. I mean, if you work with them for a couple of months, you'll get it figured out. But if it's the first dozen times you've looked at one, you could easily make a mistake. So I think it's fair to say to employer, as long as you use that information in the manner that we've told you to use it in the regulations, fine. You can't be sued for denying employment to someone who's got a sex assault conviction on their background. But if you deny employment to someone with an old DWI conviction or a charge of assault that you were never convicted on, that's not a good reason.
I don't think that's any problem at all. I think employers have no problem with that. But I would say if the entity or individual service provider reasonably relies on that information required by the department to be considered before employment in denying employment, then I think we solve the whole problem. But I will tell you that as an employer, I could make a decision based on the character of the individuals, based on a whole lot of different things, which would never be entered into the record. Mm-hmm. And so an employer always has to, through the personal interview background and other things, determine whether or not this person they're considering hiring is of the character that they want to provide the services for which they're being hired. So, and that's always a right of someone in a Human Rights Commission to be able to bring that. But to hold them liable for making a decision that where they find that it appears on the record that there's a barrier crime from employment, I think we have to hold the employer harmless for information that was received by that employer that may have been in error. And that's, I think, what we're trying to do here. If an entity or an individual service provider reasonably relies on that information that is required to be considered before employment in denying employment by the department, required by the department to be considered before employment, then I think we can solve that. And if we want to do that conceptually and make sure that it's worded to that effect, I have no objection to that. You want to try to, should we try to roll that into a conceptual amendment and allow the drafters to work this out rather than us to stumble with it?
The idea being that as long as the employer uses the information in the manner prescribed by the regulations, there's immunity.
Right.
If he uses it in some other manner, there's not.
Why don't you, we propose a conceptual amendment, and we'll call that number 1A, and to the amendment that would require that immunity be only for decisions that were made based on information that was required by the department. Yes. Okay. Is there objection to that amendment? To the amendment?
No.
Yes, Stacy.
No, Mr. Chair.
No.
Not from the department.
Okay. Thank you very much, and we will go ahead and we'll adopt that amendment to the amendment. Other questions? Well, let's move on to page 2 of the amendment.
Okay. And so, bullet 7 is just the deletion, as I mentioned earlier, from page 34 and then moving to page 17. So that's just a conforming amendment. Bullet number 8 is, if you recall last week when we were before the body, before the committee, we discussed amending the definition of assisted living home license to meet some issues from the provider community. Well, there was another provision in the bill that defined assisted living, so we made that conforming amendment so everything's consistent. The same definition applies regardless of where you're looking in the statute. Bullet number 9 is the conforming edit to number 1, where we deleted section 6 and we had to make the similar deletion on page 42, or is the inclusion of a repealer on page 42. And page 42, line 30, line 16, that that one here, I'm gonna find my amendment. And that again is, as you recall, the conforming amendment to the change we made on bullet number 2. So it is. When we repealed in the earlier part of the bill, we need to make sure we repealed the corresponding section in the back. And the remaining amendments would be numbering issues.
Okay. Is there further objection to this amendment? Seeing none, amendment number one is adopted. Further proposed amendments to this bill? Seeing none, is there anyone that wants to further testify on the bill? Seeing none, we will close public testimony. Amendments are done. Will of the committee.
Mr. Chair, I move the committee substitute for Senate Bill number 125, version India, with as amended with attached individual comments.
Is there objection? Hearing none, Senate Bill CS for Senate Bill 125 is moved to the next committee of referral. Thank you, and just a short recess.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Back on the record, we're now going to take a look at two bills, 127 and 186. And Senator French, I don't want to try to summarize your bill for me, but the primary portion of your bill is the definition of unethical conduct. As you have had an opportunity to take a look at that, could you tell me on the portions having to do with section 110B, the potential violations of section 110B of the current statute, could you give me kind of the differences in the approach that you've taken versus the approach in 186?
See if I can put them side by side here. It might be easier for me just to, of course you've heard this bill, so there's more point in me walking through. I think.
Right.
Everyone here, except for maybe Senator Guess, has heard the bill. But let me get yours side by side. I've just got my stuff arranged in a certain way. Looking for it. 186. This is it. Okay. Mr. Chairman, both your bill and my bill attempt to clear up the loophole, I think, that the Rinkus case brought to everyone in the state's attention. My bill takes the approach, your bill takes out insignificant, just simply says there's no impropriety, or no, your word takes out the word substantial, says there's no impropriety, and then works through some of the permutations. Both bills say there's no impropriety if the action or influence would have an insignificant or conjectural effect, and I think everybody agrees that that should stay in there. You've got to have some provision that says if the action you took wouldn't have an effect and no reasonable person would believe it would have an effect on your investment, then you can have $100 million worth of stock in a company, but if what you're doing doesn't affect that stock, it doesn't matter, that's fine. My bill does that number one, your bill does that number two. My bill takes this question about interests that are insignificant or possessed by the public or large class of persons. And your bill, in essence, leaves it alone in section one. And I've wrestled this question around. I'm leaving the hardest part till the last, but I want to talk about this for a second. My section two and your section one are very similar, and I think of the two approaches, in this specific instance, your approach is right. You've got to have personal or financial interest, and it actually came up because of a question that Senator Terrio asked me last time about, what if I make a decision on the gas line, and the gas line raises the value of my home in Fairbanks? That is a financial interest. It's not a personal interest. Anything that involves money is a financial interest. And yet, no one would say that's wrong for you to do that because, frankly, the rising tide that lifts all boats is a good thing, and most people would agree. Now, if it only affected, you know, half of Fairbanks, that half of Fairbanks on this side of the railroad tracks, and it hurt that side on the other side, that'd be a different question. But I think you've got to have personal or financial interest in that sentence. And so if we were to go with my bill, I'd add or financial. In the reason, just if I could spend another second on that, because I spent a lot of time thinking about this, and the reason I was concerned about having financial interest in there is because I believe that if you had both, if you had a bunch of stock in the company that was going to build the gas pipeline, and you also owned a home in Fairbanks, and you voted to build the pipeline, you would help your house price, but you'd help everybody in Fairbanks' house price, but you'd also help your stock price. And I was concerned that in that instance, if you had both a widely held financial interest and a narrow financial interest, you could be excused from wrongdoing because of the way this is written. But I believe I think that was a thinking error on my part. I think that it would be as to that specific matter. So you could be charged with two ethics violations, one for having raised the price of your home by voting to put in a gas line, and two for having raised the price of your stock for having put in a gas line. And you would be acquitted on the first charge because everybody has that same interest, that home price interest. And yet, only a few people have the stock interest, and you would be hung up on that one. And so I think that as to both of our clauses on those two matters, they're roughly equal, or they should be roughly equal, and they're both appropriate. Now, that leaves the hard one, and that's the third one. The approach I took is different than your approach, and I guess I would sort of turn around and want to ask you a couple questions about how you see the series of ands that you have in your bill on lines 5 through 18 of 186.
What page?
Page 2.
I version?
The I version, yeah.
Of your bill?
This bill. It's F version of
F of mine, and I have Y, Yankee, of yours. Sorry, maybe I'm missing the most recent.
Oh, yeah. Let me see.
I've got India.
India?
I have India, too.
Hey,
do we have the Yankee version here, Brian?
No, I is the...
I is the one that came to us.
Hot one? Current one?
It's the one that came to us is the last.
All right, I've got...
I have Yankee.
You got Yankee as well? I need an India copy before I go any further.
430 is I. And we that's the one that came to us.
That's the proposed judiciary CS.
Oh, okay.
Oh.
Oh, all right, yeah. All right. We have to adopt that. But we're just kind of open discussion on the two.
I just don't have a copy.
I don't have a copy either.
Okay. We'll get it. You want?
I doubt and if nothing changed on that portion, because I know you've been...
It hasn't.
Okay.
It's the same.
Then my reading of your... subsection 4 on page 2, beginning on line 5, says there's no impropriety if, as to a specific matter, a public officer's personal or financial interest in a matter is in regard to a business, and a public officer, one, does not own a controlling interest in the business, and, two, B, does not own more than 1% of the stock in the business, and the stock owned has a value of less than $10,000. I had a hard time figuring out how number two would work. And I remember writing myself a note saying, well, what if you own 2% of the stock, but it's only $5,000?
Basically, trying to determine the value of the stock of a company by percentage, 0% of nothing is still nothing.
Right.
And 100% of nothing is still nothing. Most people can certainly determine how many dollars something is. So if you had a company where you owned 50% of the stock and it was still worse than less than $10,000, we're just trying to say everybody understands what a dollar is.
Right.
Nobody understands the value of a stock.
Right.
And so that's kind of where we were trying to tie.
So if you owned 100% of the company and the company was in total was worth $5,000, no impropriety.
It's a pretty de minimis company,
right,
and no impropriety. That's correct.
And if you own 0.5% of the stock, but it's Microsoft and you've got, you know, $10 million there, then impropriety.
Yes.
Because
that would be an equity interest in the business worth less than $10,000.
So
if you had an equity interest, which is a stock value,
right,
of more than $10,000, impropriety, if you didn't follow the procedure. So we're trying to establish equity value somewhere in dollars.
And would any one of these, do you have to make all of these together to be exempt, or does any one of them exempt you?
Under the current structure,
if you don't own a controlling interest in the business, that's obviously no impropriety.
Yep.
But if you own $1 million worth of stock, so it sounds like to me you've got to clear every one of these hurdles in your bill in order to be relieved of liability.
That's basically what I've said.
That's the way you meant.
Yes.
Right.
You can't jump over any one of these hero. Right.
Unless you jump through all these hoops, you're caught.
You must then do something about it. Yes. In other words, this isn't just one hurdle or the other. It's you got to make them all. Mm-hmm. That's how it's crafted. That's how it's meant to be crafted. And I think it reads that way.
I needed to work through it and talk to you about it and see if that's right. Then I think, the only yours is more thorough than mine. I think it's got some, the not having a contract is not an employee, not an elected officer. Those are good things. I agree with them.
As I basically saw our differences, it was in the dollar value.
I think that's right.
And then I tried to roll a few more things in as I talked to CPAs, other people, to try to figure out how to determine. See, values are very difficult. Company's value, a sale value of a company, are we talking about the book value? Do we roll in the blue sky value, which is not determinable? How do we make something that someone can understand and that really has significance in trying to protect the public interest is what I was trying to get to.
But it sounds like the only place that would have an application is not in a stock or it's if you owned a slice of, Joe's Tire Company in Fairbanks and you're thinking, okay, the gas line, we're going to sell a bunch of tires. And if you own a little tiny slice, it's not a factor, but if you own a pretty big slice, it might get to be one.
Yeah. That's true. You've got to take a look at something, but what is a slice? It could be a brand. It could be a conceptual company. It could be, I don't know. We have to have some real things to look at. That's the hard part of trying to set up a bright line. We have to, when we shine the light on it, there should be more than a hallucination. It has to be something real to take a look at, and that's what I'm trying to boil it down to. Something real to look at. When it's got three dimensions, it's you can feel it, touch it, smell it. And that's the hard part in trying to set this is where to make that, where to put it, and how to define it. And how to define it is harder than where to put it.
I hadn't thought about it until now, but you could imagine a situation where someone says, okay, we're gonna construct this gas line that's gonna go near Fairbanks. And now that I've made that decision, quick, let's go run and invest in a tire company.
Betcha. You got it.
Let's go start a tire company and sell a bunch of tires.
And so I'm trying to basically, as much as possible, put three dimensions on this thing that we can clearly define, and then we all that's left is just how big the box is.
I think it's a good and thorough series of hoops, and so.
Okay, let's go.
Yep, time to go.
We're going to have to recess until after the floor session is over. We'll reconvene the Senate Judiciary Committee. And when we left, we were discussing, Senator French was discussing similarities and differences between 127 and 186.
Right.
186. And so go ahead, Senator French.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Probably the other difference that we need to go into is on page 2, line 3 and 4. Your bill has a exemption for those interests held in a blind trust and interests where the public officer does not have management control over the financial interest. And I just don't know enough about the different types of accounts you can have, and I don't know what you have in mind in that setting.
Probably the thing that I'm looking at there, Senator, is a blind trust. In order to set one up, you'd have to have assets somewhere in the vicinity of $1 million or more. If someone had less than that in terms of their investments or financial interests, and they could put those into replicating funds. They could put them into a broker-managed fund where they had no management control over that financial interest as to what was bought or what was sold or when it was bought or when it was sold. The buying and selling decisions were made strictly by the broker, not by the manager, by the owner. And then I could see in a case of a potential conflict of interest where we would not necessarily tell the person who may be the most qualified person in state government to address a particular matter or to be a part of a negotiating team, for an example, we would not necessarily have to preclude them from that if we could find some way to take their hands off the investment in a manner that was very clear. And we talk about that farther on when an employee goes to their manager, their advisor, and says, I have this potential conflict of interest, what should I do? And the manager were able to say, if you put your interest in this type of a management control where you have no direct management, then you can continue working on that particular project for the state. So we're trying to find a balance of where someone can make that decision being open, that decision being part of the regular process that we go through on a daily basis. Barbara probably could tell us how that's done now, for an example. What would you come up maybe, and because you are sometimes an advisor, I understand.
Sometimes.
You could put yourself on the record, maybe help us in our discussion here.
Yes, Barbara Ritchie, Chief Assistant Attorney General, Department of Law. I head up a section called Opinions, Appeals, and Ethics, which handles ethics.
So, Barbara, in your experience, if someone came to you and says, I have a potential violation, what do you normally do? Conflict of interest or whatever.
What we do, often those kinds of inquiries come to us via the designated ethics supervisors in each of the agencies. Sometimes those people come to us, they've been asked a question and are not sure how to handle it, and then other times we just get the question directly, and we're asked for an advisory opinion, and we gather all of the facts, because all of these, at least in my experience, these ethics situations are very fact-specific and very individual. I mean, we certainly have some guiding principles, but you really need to look carefully at the facts. We research the situation both factually and legally, both our opinions and any other research we might need to do, and we do an advisory opinion. That's basically how we go about it.
And so what I'm envisioning here, Senator, is even farther down in the bill where, and you'll have to excuse my voice, I had an allergic reaction yesterday. It's kind of affected my voice a little bit. I apologize. Where the under Section 17 of this bill, with the even the personnel board were to determine that a public employee has violated the chapter, that they may order the same type of a divestiture or establishment as part of their remedy through their action. But we're saying, if earlier in the process, if they go through, what do they call it? What's the direct person would go to their designated
ethics supervisor.
Right.
And
that ethics supervisor then could make that decision at that point in time that this is a way you could avoid the conflict.
One other thing I was going to say, a good example just recently was with now Attorney General Marcus, who when he was being considered for possible appointment as Attorney General, came to me and made disclosure as to all his personal financial interests. and asked for a review of those. And I can speak about this because he waived his confidentiality. And one of the things that we analyzed those, and I can certainly give you a copy of that opinion, but the type of situation of where you have no management control, he had those sorts of accounts through mutual funds where and it was the first time, as far as I'm aware of, that we did an opinion on what the interest is, somebody's financial interest in a mutual fund, and whether that precludes them from taking any sort of official action, where you have a situation where the mutual fund itself might have some investment in a company that public officer takes some action regarding. And consistent with opinions in other states and judicial canons, we concluded that mutual funds are not a financial interest in which the public officer has control such that it would preclude them from taking official action.
And so that's what we're trying to replicate here.
Right.
On that point, my small amount of research into that subject leads me to believe that it's a rare mutual fund that has more than 5% in any one stock. And I don't know if you did similar research or if there's some more reputable financial analysis of that sort of eyeball approach, but that's just my sense, is that most mutual funds, their biggest holding is probably 2 to 3%, and it's a rare case where they go over 5. They try to avoid that type of situation. Does that comport with your...
Yes, I can't say we researched different mutual funds and exactly what they hold, but we were looking at ones where at least in his situation, that was widely diversified mutual fund.
But getting back, if I could, just to this
sure,
idea about management control, I think it's a rational approach with one caveat, and that is as long as the asset in question wasn't one that the public officer put in the account. The public officer, say, let's just take Mr. Marquez as an example. He's about to try to get confirmed as Attorney General. Say he's got $100,000 worth of ConocoPhillips because of his years of service with the company. If he puts that stock in the management account, he knows it's there. He's going to get monthly statements on it. It's not a blind trust. And 6 weeks later, makes a decision that hugely benefits ConocoPhillips. That strikes me that he shouldn't be absolved of that because he put the asset there. He knows the asset's there, and he's just made a decision that helps that asset out. If he puts a bunch of money in this account and they buy ConocoPhillips without him asking, that's a different situation, and he doesn't know it's there. I guess I'm still hung up on him knowing it's there and him making a decision to affect that investment, whether or not you can buy it or sell it. It still seems just as much in your interest to affect an asset you didn't buy as one you did. So I'm almost...
I understand what you're saying, Senator
knowledge
French.
Component I'm hung up
but
on.
But once that person puts it in a broker-managed fund that precludes his management, any management input, he may receive quarterly reports that be about the extent of it. He wouldn't even know whether he owned that stock the next day or not. He would not know, have no direct knowledge of whether the broker who now manages the account has sold that stock or has reduced the holdings of that stock or whatever he or she did in terms of the management of the stock. Senator Theriault.
I have a problem with suggesting that people just have to divest themselves of things that they perhaps have held for a long time just because of the requirements of their job. Certainly, we don't want somebody actively buying and selling while they're perhaps, making an announcement that a permit's denied or permit's under review, and so the stock dips. Well, that's a buying opportunity, and the next week you're going to approve the permit, and then the stock's going to pop up. I mean, you don't want that active buying and selling, but the fact that somebody owns something and perhaps has owned it for 20 years, I don't know that you want to require that they divest themselves of that.
And you may.
The issue is not whether they own it or not. The issue is whether they use their public office to influence the investment. They're free to own all of BP as long as they never make a decision that influences the company.
Senator Huggins.
Mr. Chair, if I read this correctly, if you look on page 3 and you go through the process, in section 8, the public employee's designated supervisor takes a look at it. It may go to the Attorney General, and then it talks about some exist or will, and you can reassign the duties, you can direct the divestiture removal, or place in a blind trust. So it goes through a process of evaluation, which potentially involves both the Attorney General and the employee supervisor.
And I think here, as I understand this, if somebody owned $1 million in Exxon stock and they were assigned to a job that it would that where they knew there was they had now failed to cross one of the hurdles, that they would be compelled under the law to seek the advice of their designated advisor. Am I correct?
That's correct.
So they'd be compelled to do that at that time, and that person could advise them on what they should do, should advise them as to what they should do at that time.
Right, exactly.
And they would be compelled to accept that advice or be in violation of the law. Am I correct there?
That's right. That's how the process should work, and that's how it's supposed to work. And that you make those disclosures, and it's not just the disclosure, it is also taking action on that disclosure by the designated supervisor, by the employee themselves, before you find yourself in a situation where there's a conflict. So it's
so if right. You had a massive investment in something that designated supervisor felt could put you in a position of jeopardy where you might not represent the public's good ahead of your own good, they have the right to say you must divest yourself of that stock, or you must put that stock in a account that you have no management control over. All those options are there, and that person either accepts that recommendation or doesn't do that job.
That's correct. They can also be, somebody could be reassigned. Say, well, if they said, well, I just can't do that, then I guess, assuming they can do some other job, they could be reassigned to some other job. I think the concept here is to lay out these options, because each situation is so somewhat different. There may be instances where divestiture really jumps out as being that is really the best option.
Or you don't do this job.
Right. Or you don't do this job. One comment on the discretionary managed kind of accounts, and we addressed that in the opinion for Attorney General Marcus as well, and he has two discretionary managed accounts where his broker makes investments without his prior approval, without his prior knowledge. However, he does receive monthly reports. He could look at how his account is doing online every day if he wanted to. And what we advised in those circumstances, those accounts currently do not have any holdings that involve Alaska corporations, Alaska oil companies doing business in Alaska, and as I recall, any oil companies at all. And he had already placed restrictions on those to not have any investments in oil companies, and he was placing additional restrictions to make sure that there wouldn't be any circumstance where he would have a holding that he wasn't aware of that was a company doing business in Alaska that he might have some involvement in. Yes. As Attorney General. So
and
those,
I
think,
that's the only management control you can have on those types of accounts are the restrictions against investing in certain entities. But in this case, he followed the correct procedure in that he requested the advice of his designated ethics supervisor.
Right. But I think those, at least in my mind, are the kinds of things that if we were advising, if this language became law, mutual funds or these kinds of accounts where you say you need to put these restrictions on there and those are put on and you know they're in place, those are the kinds of things that I think a designated ethics supervisor or the Attorney General would be looking for to implement.
So, and this process is a public process and discoverable.
Pardon me?
And this process of an ethics advisor making the recommendation could be discoverable.
Notices of potential violation and requests for Attorney General's advice currently are confidential. And the Attorney General's advice is confidential.
They could be discoverable in case of charges brought.
it would really depend on whether the subject, the person, was willing, wanted to waive their confidentiality.
Let's say the personnel board brought an action against someone.
Uh-huh.
Could they request that under discovery rules and get a copy of that opinion?
Oh, right. I would think so, yes. Yes.
So there is a traceable history of if charges are brought. And, of course, the person could waive that confidentiality anytime they wanted to.
Correct. And employees can also rely on advice given by the Attorney General and their designated ethics supervisor, provided that they have disclosed all the facts, provided they follow that advice, and that the facts don't change. If new facts come up, they need to come back for additional guidance.
So in some respects, Senator, I'm saying here are the hurdles. But in order to jump over those hurdles, sometimes you've got to have somebody else tell you what to do if you get close to it, that you better get some advice. Because under the current law, you would be required to do that if even you thought it was something over which you had no control, but it had some kind of further benefit that might be a little bit suspect, violate the public trust. That's what we're after. Senator Huggins.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I guess the thing that gives me the comfort is that the public officer has to report in writing if he thinks he has a violation to his supervisor. His supervisor has to provide in writing the disposition of the concern, or if the supervisor has a concern, it's the same sort of thing. So they're both detection mechanisms, and you have to report that to the Attorney General. And then it's a sequence of actions, and the one about the blind trust is an or factor. Doesn't say it has to be. But if you're not going to reassign the duty or the person, and then you work your way through, and there are a number of alternatives which appear to me to be reasonable.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Senator Seekins, also on your earlier question about whether something would be discoverable, just another part of the process is that any notices, declarations of potential violation, as well as any actual violations, the designated ethics supervisors on a quarterly basis report all of those to the Attorney General's office. And we get stacks of this information. I mean, we get a whole packet, and we review all of that. And if we think that something's been handled by an agency in a way that maybe doesn't quite cover it, we have some concerns, we regularly follow up with those agencies to make sure that, you know, all of our concerns have been addressed. And then we do, in turn, a report to the personnel board in a redacted, they get the whole packet, and they also get a redacted form that can be made, that's made public, of the quarterly reports. So there's additional reviews. So it isn't if I call them DESs, if they're out there doing things or not doing things that, you know, are perhaps not covering all the bases, there's checks to try to pick up on that. And we do training of DESs.
So Ms. Ritchie, if I understand, how many public employees fall under this act?
All of them, all the current state employees, executive branch state employees, and members of boards and commissions that are formed by statute. So all the members of the boards and commissions that are statutory, and then in certain instances, former public officers.
So this does not just cover the governor and his immediate staff of commissioners.
Oh no!
Just for the record, because some people think that it does.
No, it covers.
As far-reaching effects on
right.
what we do here.
Right.
That's why I'm trying to be very careful, I guess, because I looked at the universe of people who could be in jeopardy and tried to take that into consideration in my processes here.
I think we've covered that point.
Okay. Other point.
As can be. I maintain some reservations about it, but
I understand.
There's no point in beating a dead dog. The last big difference between our two bills, Mr. Chairman, is I don't know that you redefine official action the way SB 127 does on page 2, lines 12 through 16.
I don't recall that I do either, and I wanted to have you explain how that would be in effect, Senator.
The impetus for this redefinition really came out of the Rankin's affair as well, in that I think the Attorney General took a fairly narrow view of what official action was. His deposition, he said, you know, I got all the way up to the point of signing the MOU when I realized that was going to be going too far, that was going to be official action. And so that's when I fell back and said, no, someone else has to sign this. From my perspective, just about anything an employee, state employee does while during, you know, the workday, while that person's on the clock is official action. So, you know, having a thought about state business, reducing that thought to a concrete email, sending that off to somebody else, that's official action. Having a conversation on the telephone about how to resolve a case is official action. As a regulator, going out in the field and looking at the area that you're going to review a permit for, that's official action. And so I just wanted to make certain that subsequent employees, just like your concern about all the state employees, they should know that most of the things they do during the course of the day are official action. So that's the rationale behind that.
Ms. Ritchie, would you have any comments on that?
Senator Seekins, I think I've always looked at the current definition of official action as pretty broad as is. Senator French's proposal, I don't know if it expands on it or it gives more of an articulation to what official action is. I frankly don't disagree that it's much broader than when you actually sign on the dotted line. By the time you're signing something, you've probably done scads of official action up to that point. So I don't have any particular objection to Senator French's language. I don't know that we particularly need it either, because the way I've always interpreted it, and when we do the trainings, I tell people over and over again that official action is very broad, and it covers a wide range of things that you do every day.
Well, you know, how would I know that I might have a potential conflict if I didn't review it?
If you didn't review...
Whatever. Let's say I had a document that came across my desk, and in the course of my official action, I reviewed that document. I wouldn't know the content of it until after I had reviewed it. So would I be getting the horse ahead of the cart here, or behind the cart?
I see what you're saying. If it included review.
It's the course of the review that would lead me to a conclusion I might have a potential conflict.
Mm-hmm.
I'd hate to be charged for that.
Right. I guess overall, through the chair, Senator French, I'm comfortable with our current definition of official action. I think that if somebody reads that, and at least as we have told people over and over again in trainings, is it's broad. If you know, when in doubt, you should assume that you're doing official action. Includes recommendations, approvals, disapprovals, action or inaction by the public officer. So if you're in a meeting and you say, I think we should move forward with this, or, I don't know, when in doubt, I would assume that I'm making official action.
Is this the underlined or unadded portion, the current official definition of official action?
Yes.
Right, yeah, page 2, lines 11 through 16 are the definitions, and the underlined portion are words I suggest be added. And again, I would just go back and say, I mean, I'm not going to put you on the spot and say, you know, was what the Attorney General did official action, but I just know that he believed it was not, and it just seems like it's open for confusion, and I feel that it should be, as Ms. Ritchie describes, very broad, and these words amplify that rationale.
I don't particularly have a problem with the words other than review. I mean, I understand what you're trying to get at. I do believe it's probably there, because all these things are regarding a matter such as a recommendation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So if they all flow into recommendations, decisions, approvals, disapprovals, votes, or other similar actions. So if we're kind of just, you know, these actions that are regarding another action, such as, so I don't know that we're, and I looked at this, and I have no problem with trying to expand the definition of things to clearly state what we intend to carry out. I don't have a problem with that. I get slapped on the hand a lot by the drafters when I put too many words in that they, but, you know, I'm always in favor of putting the words in that clarify what our intent is so that no one misunderstands. Because when someone, a lot of potential ethics violations can come through, can result from someone not having a clear understanding of what we're trying to accomplish. And that's what we want to avoid. So your yellow book is
up there. Oh, there it is. There's my statute. Okay.
I'm sorry. So I guess I don't have any objection to that particular thing. I just wanted to know what we were doing and how whether we were changing the grid size of the net. Or I guess.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. That pretty much concludes my bill, and so that's that. Those are the differences, with the exception, of course, of the broader scope of your bill.
My intent, if we can reach some kind of an agreement farther on, would be if we go forward with 186 to look at how we could add that definition, or if it needs to be clarified, in the opinion of the lady in charge of ethics in the executive branch. And I think other than the part that we've talked about with the how those accounts could be managed, I believe that Senator French and I are trying to define the same box, but just the size of the box is our difference.
Between the 5 and the 10, yep. I agree. I think your definition, page 2, lines 4, or lines 5 through 18, is a good definition, okay. With the exception of the dollar figure.
So with that, my intent would be to discuss those values that are contained in Senator French's bill as we go through Senate Bill 186, and also to consider the amendment that he has added for Definition 14 as a possible inclusion in 186, just so that I made sure that we didn't have any other substantive differences that we would need to discuss.
That's it. Thank you.
Okay. Let's proceed with 186, if we will. Ms. Ritchie, you've had a chance to review Senate Bill 186.
Yes, sir.
Do you have any particular concerns with this bill that you would like to address with us?
Senator Seekins, it seems to me this bill does sort of accomplishes three major things. One is the one we've just been talking about, and I think it does a good job of setting a bright line on what constitutes a significant personal or financial interest in a matter. The second would be there's some changes in here on confidentiality. And the changes as the bill was first introduced were much broader, and much more would become confidential. This bill, this one I'm looking at, which is this work draft for the committee substitute, is much more in line with what current law is, with some minor changes.
You just ticked something over in my mind, and that I would move version I as the working document for the committee.
Okay.
Is there objection? Hearing none, we'll work with version I. It's adopted as our working document.
Okay.
I'm sorry for the housekeeping, but my mind just caught up with you.
So I just wanted to sort of, having listened the other night to the hearing in the Senate State Affairs Committee, this bill does not dramatically change the current law on confidentiality of executive branch ethics matters. but we can talk about what the what it does do on confidentiality. And the third major thing it does is set up a mechanism set out in the law on what the steps are if there is an ethics, if there is a allegation of an ethics violation made with regard to the governor, the lieutenant governor, or the attorney general. And that was something that we didn't have, we don't have, articulated in our current law, and I think also caused some amount of concern and discussion with regard to former Attorney General Rinkus and how that particular allegation, short of a complaint, prior to there being any ethics complaint, was handled. So as I see it, those are the three major things that this bill does. In addition, there's other changes, but I think it's an improvement to our ethics law. This
you've worked with our current law for how long?
Well, I've been heading up this section for 2 years now, and then prior to that, just if my work in the Attorney General's office, I certainly had involvement in some of the ethics matters, but not as up close and personal as now.
You had some concern with the effective date, and you'll notice that on section 22, we've established the effective date of January 1st, 2006. For the record, could you tell us why you requested that effective date?
Yes, I did request that because we are, one of the things I've been doing since being in charge of ethics is making a real effort and sort of in a systematic way of doing regular trainings for state managers, designated ethics supervisors, boards and commissions, sort of anybody I can get to come to our trainings, we do trainings. And I would like to have an opportunity to do trainings on changes that would be this significant in the law so that people would have an opportunity to review their financial holdings, determine what they, if anything, they may need to do with respect to those, for example. Revamp our training materials. And we may need to make some changes to our regulations as well to reflect these kinds of changes in the law. So that was the reason for additional time.
Okay.
One other thing, Senator Seekins, I probably should mention because I know it has had some discussion is the first section about making a disclosure of confidential ethics information a misdemeanor. I just wanted to point out that for whatever it's worth, the law from 1986 when it was first adopted till 1998 when it went through a pretty substantial amendment had in it that violation of the confidentiality provisions of the Ethics Act was a Class A misdemeanor. And to my knowledge, no one was ever prosecuted under that. And in 98, that provision was taken out. And the only thing I can find, at least in our bill review, indicates that legislators felt it was too harsh a penalty. And I've now gone through all of the minutes from the legislative hearings on that bill, and I really can't find any particular discussion of that. It was just taken out. So,
Ms. Ritchie, thank you for bringing that to my attention. At this point, the chair is going to advance a conceptual amendment to the bill, particularly on line 8, page 1, that would reduce the penalty for disclosing confidential ethics information to a $5,000 fine. Now, saying that, I'd leave it to the drafters to be able to determine whether that should be a new section of the bill, which I think it might be, and who would impose that fine. If it was during the process that it had been, because we can't bring a complainant under the Personnel Board action. But the Personnel Board has now the authority to fine public officers. Is that correct, Ms.
Right.
Ritchie? Could you read that section of the statute that's in there for us?
right now, there's a civil penalty. The Ethics Act itself is not a criminal statute, although there may be criminal sanctions in addition. But the civil penalty that the Personnel Board may impose on current or former public officers is a civil penalty not to exceed $5,000 for a violation of this chapter.
Which would include confidentiality sections.
That's correct. That's correct.
What my intent is here to revise this to subject the complainant or others of his people who he's brought into his realm of confidentiality, who are now brought under the same confidentiality requirements as the other folks in the process, to have a civil penalty of $5,000, and to allow the complainant. There was a provision in Oregon law, and Ms. Ritchie, maybe you could review that for us as well, that allowed the complainant to pursue that.
Right. I think, I went back and I did look at the Oregon law, and they have a civil penalty for violation of confidentiality provisions. And I'm not sure exactly how this would apply here, but I think by complainant, you're talking about someone who's not otherwise a current or former public officer under the Act.
Well, here I should say the person, I'm not complaining, I'm saying the person complained against that would have the right to make sure that, or to pursue the fact that that penalty was imposed.
Oh, I'm correct, sorry. Right. Well, Oregon has a provision in their section on breach of confidentiality that reads, any person aggrieved as a result of a violation of this paragraph by a member of the commission, I guess, say an ethics commission, or its staff may file a petition in court in the judicial district where the petitioner resides in order to enforce the civil penalty provided in this section. So it was to give that person, I guess, a mechanism in case they didn't want to find themselves.
My intent in there was that the aggrieved person could now include, could now bring into that same process a person who was not a member of the personnel board or of the Attorney General's office, but may have been maybe the complainant under that same type of action. Senator French?
You articulated my concern, or my analysis is that in Oregon, you can sue a member of our equivalent of the personnel board if one of those members blabs to the press or somehow publicizes the fact that a complaint's been filed against this or that public officer.
I think that, I haven't talked to anybody in Oregon, but through the chair, yes, I think that's what this is.
My intent
after.
Was to bring a double-barreled approach. That could be done by the appropriate public agency, and if it was not done for some reason, I think that the person who was aggrieved should be able to bring a civil action to that effect.
So the for lack of a better word, let's call him the defendant, could sue the complainant if the defendant believed that the complainant had publicized the filing of the complaint or otherwise breached confidentiality.
I think that's what I'm working towards. It's in the discussion here. That's what I want to lay on the table. Yep. But in fact, I would like to see it to be a civil penalty for the violation and not a criminal penalty. But I think that there should be some definite, probably the best way to get someone's attention is with their pocketbook and make it substantial. That's all we're trying to do is get someone's attention here. I don't want to put anybody in jail. Never had, but you know, we start a little higher than we might be willing to accept on some of these things. Discussion. Senator Terrio.
Ms. Ritchie, could you just go over the previous law, previous to 98, what was the length of time?
Through the chair, Senator Terrio, the Ethics Act was enacted in 1986, and I actually went through the legislative history on that as well, and the misdemeanor provision was in the bill from the very beginning. It just was always there. It didn't seem to get a lot of attention in particular. I couldn't find any discussion about it. And then till 1998 were the amendments. It was SB 105. and it took it out. In fact, in looking at that, there was a version on April 18th, that had the misdemeanor still in there, and then April 23rd, another version of the bill in another committee came out, and it was being deleted. But I just can't find any discussion as to why, in particular.
Senator Huggins?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you say again the first time that the misdemeanor showed up, the start date? You said it went out
1986.
Sorry, I missed that.
So my intent is to allow the appropriate public entity to bring to through violation of the act impose up to a $5,000 penalty or a $5,000 penalty absolute. I don't know if we want to put a range in there, but I think make it a tough enough penalty from a pocketbook standpoint, and that if for some reason there was a breach of confidentiality that had not resulted in a penalty, that allow the person who was aggrieved to file a claim for the up to $5,000. Now, I'm willing to discuss that, and I thought I'd throw that out conceptually for discussion at this time.
Well, I don't know, Mr. Chair. I like the aspect of the $5,000 in that it parallels on the other end. I mean, there may be some wisdom to have a range of minimum of not to exceed. You know, I don't know how the other committee members feel.
This now, under the public law, is not to exceed $5,000.
Correct.
I don't want someone to get a $200 slap on the hand.
Okay.
I want it to be a substantial penalty, a pocketbook penalty, not a criminal penalty. So if you're going to do it, you'd better think about it, because the effect could be on your pocketbook. Senator French.
The enforcement mechanism, I take it the enforcement mechanism would originally lie in the Attorney General's office. I mean, they're the people that we ask to enforce our laws. And so
I would think so it would here. It would not lie within the personnel board, because that's not in their consideration at that point in time. But it could, if it was a member of the public, if a public officer that violated the confidentiality, the personnel board has the right to do that under current law.
Right. Under current law, they could impose this penalty for a violation of the chapter, and the chapter is the entire Ethics Act. So if someone...
Provisions.
Right. That's how I've always read
that. On the confidentiality side, I don't care whether it's the public or not, but I would like to, I think there the Attorney General's office would enforce that. But in a Legislative Ethics Act, where I would also propose the same penalty, I'm not sure who would do that, whether it would be, well, I don't think we've given that kind of board to the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics, but I want to make sure as we go forward that we allow the drafters to find how we would implement that same penalty on that side. Senator?
It's just going to need some more articulation. It would be my position that before you can take $5,000 out of somebody's pocket, he's got some due process rights, and there's going to have to be a hearing and potentially a trial. Is going to have to decide, was this or was this not actually a breach of confidentiality, or was it something else? Did this person do it, or did somebody else do it, and so forth?
Senator Seekins, what I was thinking is, I mean, it may be possible that we could kind of do a carve-out to give the personnel board this kind of jurisdiction with respect to this, I'll call him a third person, you know, somebody, some member, if the complainant, for example, is not a public officer. Often they are. Often it's people in agencies, but they're just a person out there. And to give the personnel board that jurisdiction over them in this particular instance, so that, I agree with you, so that there is a process for that, for a hearing to consider that particular issue and appeal process beyond that.
And that would normally take place now with someone who violated the statute as well?
Yes.
Here's what I'm going to conceptually propose then, that we ask the drafters to add a new section to the violation portion, which is section what?
It's 3952-440.
And that if, and that they have the authority to enforce or to impose a $5,000 fine on any person who violates the confidential ethics confidentiality requirements of this statute. So that they could have up to a $5,000 fine on other violations and a $5,000 fine if they violate the confidentiality portions. Senator French?
Well, I disagree with the approach in the first place, but I got to point out that I don't think the personnel board would have any jurisdiction over a citizen who files a complaint. I mean, this citizen walks free on the okay. face of the state, and well, the personnel board says you come in for a hearing, he'll say, never heard of you, don't know who you are, and I'm not right. showing up.
We'll make it an either or. In the case of someone who is not a public officer, the authority would be given to the Department of Law. Certainly every public employee who violated that confidentiality would be subject to the personnel provisions as they currently are, a personnel board as they currently are. Is that correct,
Ms. Ritchie? That's correct. That's correct.
Is there further discussion on the concept?
Just as I guess I can't, because I kind of disagree with the fundamental approach, I guess I have to ask, in my knowledge, there's been sort of one flagrant violation of this, and it actually, was it legislative or executive? The one where, I think it was the executive director of my party that went on TV saying, I'm filing this complaint.
That was legislative.
That was legislative. But even using that as an example.
There's never, I don't know of other confidentiality breaches because there's been no confidentiality requirements on the person filing a complaint under the Executive Act. There are no confidentiality requirements there now.
You're asking me
is that correct? If I bring a complaint, I can file the complaint publicly and I can talk about it all I want to. Is that correct?
I think your bill makes it more explicit that to the complainant and to the subject of the complaint without any question that it's confidential. Mm-hmm. However, when right now, under current law, when we get a complaint and we send that out or we start investigating, we always tell the complainant and we tell the subject of the complaint and we tell anybody we're talking to that the complaint's confidential, that they are not to talk to anybody else about this at all, I mean, that it's confidential under law, and we do our best to try to, you know, maintain that confidentiality. Frankly, it's very difficult, particularly with agencies. People just simply talk. That's just what happens. The reality is people talk to each other, and before you know it, it seems like, you know, the entire agency is aware of something. I mean, I can think of any number of instances like that. But we do tell people repeatedly, this is confidential. When we send out a complaint we put on it the envelope, personal, to be opened by addressee only, and always have that, you know, caution that this is confidential. And then sometimes people waive confidentiality. They just don't care. I mean, it doesn't matter to them. In fact, they maybe perhaps see some strategic or other benefit to making it public.
In your case, a complaint, it must be in writing, and it must be under oath, and it must set forth the particulars of the violation. Am I correct?
That's correct. Right.
So there's an actual form that must be filed.
We do require it to be under oath and to set out the particulars so that people are, when they do it, they're basically swearing that this is true and correct information to the best of their knowledge.
But there's nothing in the statute that would say if the press just happens to be there when I deliver that to the appropriate agency, that I say, oh my, how did you guys get here? What am I here for? Oh, I'm filing an ethics complaint against Senator French or the Attorney General or the Governor or Senator French would not be there as a, in this, under this act, but, and, well, how come? Well, because he did this, 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 and this. Is there any penalty to the person that does that, that's on his way or right there to handle a complaint across?
No. No,
that, I'm trying to get to.
No, there's not. And if somebody feels that a public officer has violated the Ethics Act, you know, what is confidential right now is a complaint. Once there's a, those kinds of proceedings underway, this the complaint is confidential, the investigation is confidential, and
that's the actual documents in the complaint or
right.
The matter of the complaint.
Well, we don't confirm or deny whether we have a complaint.
Right. Okay.
And just to clarify, current law says the Attorney General and all persons contacted during the course of an investigation shall maintain confidentiality regarding the existence of the investigation.
Right.
And I guess I would assume in most cases the Attorney General or anyone who conducts the investigation is going to talk to the person that filed the complaint and probably going to talk to that person first. Where else would you go for information? So, frankly, I think that the law is pretty clear that these investigations are confidential as it stands.
I think my conceptual amendment is that we would put under paragraph B on line 8, page 1, that disclosing confidential ethics information would be a violation of the law, and a civil penalty of $5,000 be assessed. And the conception would be to make it, to put that under the authority of the proper legal entity, depending on who the person was. Is there further objection to the conceptual amendment? Hearing none, it's adopted as amendment number 1. Okay. Are there any, Senator Huggins?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. I would be interested in, Senator French had some reservations in the blind trust stepped process before. If we could just
sure. Hear
those real quickly again,
Senator French.
It's a concern not so much about the blind trust, obviously. Although I think you could even in that instance have a problem where a person puts an asset in a blind trust, knows exactly what he puts in the blind trust, 6 weeks later makes a big decision about one of the stocks he puts in there, hoping, thinking, for whatever reason, under the impression that chances are no one's churned that whole account upside down in the course of 6 weeks, that it's still in there and that the asset's going to be affected. So in the blind trust area, I guess I'd put a little temporal, to tighten it down, and put a temporal aspect to it, 6 months, something like that. And as far, but that's less of a concern than the management control. I think Ms. Ritchie's given us some interesting information about the types of instructions you can give your broker about the investments that he or she can make with your money that will never come into contact with your job. And those sound like good directions. And I guess if I knew that each one of these accounts would come equipped with that direction, that is, all state employees that put their assets into these non-management control accounts also sign a set of instructions to their broker saying these are the sorts of constraints I want you to put on my investments. At that point, I'm like, okay, this is sounding like a pretty good idea. But the way it stands now, I think a person could give their money to a broker and say, well, he makes my decisions, she makes my decisions, you know, they do all the management, and yet they, you know, the officer knows what's in there, and the officer can look at it online, and the officer may not have management control, but he or she still has a real good idea of what's in the account and could make a decision based not on their public service, but based on what's in their account.
Actually, I would tell you this, that I would think that putting the money in a brokerage management account over which I had no management control would be much more I'd be much more nervous about that than putting in a blind trust, quite frankly, because a blind trust has some, as I understand it, a few more fiduciary responsibilities on the part of the trustee than putting it in a brokerage account that's managed by a broker. For example, if I was if I owned a large ranch and I became a U.S. senator and I put that land in a blind trust, the implication is that someday down the road I'm going to get my ranch back. It's going to come back out of the blind trust, but the management of it is done without my input, the day-to-day management of it. And if I come back 20 years later and I find out that the trustee has sold off my ranch, I may have a cause of action against that trustee that I would not have against the manager of an account to which I have agreed not to have any management control. If I was going to tighten this up any at all, I would say, where the public officer has agreed in writing not to exert any management control. Because now we're getting into the brokerage accounts have very tight restrictions, and you'd have to look at them. They're going to have all kinds of waivers. They are absolutely going to, they're not going to allow any input. Otherwise, they're violating their agreement, and they are subject to all kinds of other penalties. So if I had to strengthen this, Senator French, I would put where the public officer has agreed in writing as part of the agreement, does not have any management control over the financial interest. So that you just couldn't say, well, I gave it to Harry, and Harry's doing my investment for me. You bring up a good point.
How good a broker is Harry? That's the real question.
Really good, but I'm trying to distance myself a little bit from Harry. And Senator Huggins?
Well, Mr. Chair, as I read this, this is not Huggins gets hired by the state, and there's an action review by the Attorney General, the supervisor, and it's over with. It's a living process that as you take on a duty that you mandatorily are required to report that to your supervisor. If you think you have, and you have to do that in writing, and the supervisor has to make a determination in writing, and it has to be reported to the Attorney General in writing. And then it gives some very specific things that will happen. Duties will be reassigned to cure or feasible or direct the divestiture or the removal. And then in the next paragraph is or placement in a blind trust. There's a step number process. So this is a living process, not a one-time thing when you get hired.
That's how I see it.
That's absolutely accurate. And we advised Attorney General Marcus, for example, I can just read this to you. We recommend you closely review, this is under the category of discretionary managed brokerage accounts, that you review your monthly statements to make sure you're not invested in a company in litigation with the state of Alaska or concerning which you might take or withhold official action. If you find that an investment has been made in a company with which you deal as a state officer or an official in a matter, you should withhold taking action until you've disclosed the potential conflict to your designated ethics supervisor. Your supervisor will review the matter under 210 and advise you of any preventative action that must be taken. So that
we're basically codifying this action now, requiring it not as a precaution but a part of complying with the law. That's what we're after.
Very clear. And the part about the trust is essentially if that piece, according to looking at it through the process, if that would not be a conflict, then that's an answer that's acceptable based right. on the consideration of what the duty of the officer is going to be, correct?
I wasn't quite following.
Blind trust.
Right.
Blind trust
right.
is an or factor so that as you go down through the process, if the blind trust will work, it's one of the things that can be done.
Correct.
If it won't work, you have to divest or you have to be reassigned.
That's correct.
Or precluded from the duties.
That's right.
So it's not just you go put things in a blind trust and you do anything you want to. It's not that at all.
That's correct.
You have to meet the litmus test, and your supervisor's involved in it.
That's how I see it. Maybe I'm incorrect.
The Attorney General knows about it. It's in writing. It's a written process.
Okay. So does anybody have any amendments that they'd like to make to this section, subparagraph 3?
I have a conceptual amendment, and it has to do with the length of time that the asset's been in the blind trust, and it has to do with a set of restrictions that an officer sends along with his or her investments when the management control is surrendered on a financial interest. And it has, and as far as the blind trust goes, it has to do with the assets being in the blind trust for 6 months or greater. And as far as the management control, it relates to the, something parallel to what Ms. Ritchie told us. Mr. Marquez, Attorney General Marquez, sent along to his broker when he put his assets out of his direct control.
And you want to apply that to all 20-some thousand employees, that they would have to give those same kinds of restrictions that the Attorney General would because of the broad scope of his authority?
If we're going to excuse, what might happen here is this. It might happen that what we're trying to avoid is a public officer who makes a decision based on his money and not on the public good. And that's the idea.
Yep.
And we may excuse a public officer who's made a decision based on his investment if that investment has been handed over to somebody else. That's what subsection 3 does. And so I think before we excuse a public officer for having made an investment decision based on his made a decision based on his investment, before we excuse that, we should take every reasonable step to keep that from happening. And I think it's not unreasonable to say we're going to draw up a little piece of paper, and it's a set of investment restrictions that we use in these situations.
Back when I used to invest in stocks, I used to say no tobacco stocks, nothing that entered into the area of moral turpitude stocks. Didn't want them in my portfolio. Didn't want to profit from their profits. So I wonder exactly how in a case like an estate employee that they could, I think in the Attorney General's case, he's being very cautious and has good foresight and good sensitivity here. But I'm not so sure I wanted to apply it down all the line, but I would say I would conceptually think that after consulting with the public officers, what do we call them?
Designated ethics supervisors.
Designated ethics supervisor. The financial matter in interest in a matter is held in a blind trust, or the public officer does not have management control over the financial interest. Would strengthen that enough for me.
I'm not going to object to it getting stronger, Mr. Chairman. I simply think that
I think that same sensitivity probably would be reviewed by the designated ethics supervisor. Would that normally be the case, Ms. Ritchie?
Yes.
So,
3 would read, after consulting with the public officer's designated ethics supervisor, the financial interest in a matter is held in a blind trust, or the public officer does not have management control over the financial interest. Is there objection? I'll put that as a number 2. Ms. Ritchie?
The only thing I was just going to mention, just to put this in context, is all of this, Section 2 is proposed amendments to 110. 110 of the Ethics Act is a section that provides overall guidance to this Code of Ethics. It's the scope of the code section. And it's important, obviously. And it does say in it that the Attorney General and designated ethics supervisors, hearing officers, and the personnel board are guided, must be guided by this section when we issue opinions, when we reach decisions. So by putting that type of language in there, this gives you the overall where there is no impropriety. You go back and you look at that. And you might have a financial interest, and then you can say, okay, well, is this a problem under 110 or not a problem under 110? So if you have in there, after consulting with the designated ethics supervisor, I think it would help to ensure that in those kinds of situations, somebody, in fact, has looked at that other than the public officer themselves. Somebody else has looked at that. And I will assure you the DESs will call our office, and we will look at that and determine whether, you know, the right steps have been taken.
Because here we're just trying to determine what could be significant.
Right.
And someone has had to look into that. And it's not significant if, after consulting there.
You know, excuse me, Mr. Chair, if I might.
Senator Huggins.
I agree with that. It appears to me that's what it says if you go to page 3.
Mm-hmm.
It says public employees designated supervisor will.
Let's take a short recess here.
And it says the supervisor shall.
We're back on the record. Senator French, this bill, I can see where your concern is, and I'll tell you what, this bill has to go through the other body all the way through, and I'm interested to see a structure that gives someone how we would craft this thing to make it actually comport. What I'm trying to do is be inclusive of mutual funds, broker-managed accounts. And my knowledge of those broker-managed accounts is that there is no direct input on what can be bought or sold, but you can place restrictions on what they can buy. That's how I understand it. I talked with a couple of those broker managers. In fact, one of them who was managing the account for Attorney General Rankus. So I think I can see, I from my knowledge of those accounts, I don't have much fear of it. Maybe if you take a look at how some of those are, and if you still have the concern, I'll join with you in working with the members on the other side as the bill goes forward to clarify that.
And there may be an easier way to do it, and that'd just be to do it perhaps by regulation, by developing a set of forms, you know, one for each, say, department. You know, if you're
right.
Looking at the department resources, here's the form that you sign that keep you out of resource stocks.
Right.
And if you work in the Department of Military and Veteran Affairs, this keeps you out of, you know, and so forth.
And I think that could be done, and I think I have when I proposed it, I had a high degree of confidence that what was there was somewhat insulated. Nothing can be absolutely insulated, but it was somewhat insulated and protected the public interest. But if you're not satisfied with that, as you look at those differently, I'll be glad to join with you and the members as I present this on the other side. Many times on the other side, I've brought amendments to my own bills before, and I'm not adverse to doing it again. Okay, let's move on to the next section. Are there any questions on Section 3 of the bill? Section 4 of the bill? Section 5 of the bill? Section 6 of the bill? Section 7 of the bill? Section 8 of the bill? Again, this just replicates what we were talking about earlier, that as part of the recommendation from the designated ethics supervisor, they can make this call as one of the options. Ms. Ritchie?
Senator Seekins, in sitting here today.
Yep.
Yesterday for a few hours. I noticed on page 4, at the top there, lines 1, 2, and 3, those amendments were made between the bill. I mean, when the bill was first introduced, it didn't have those amendments. It left in personal or financial interests. And then that was put in there by the legislative drafters, and I wasn't quite sure why the change. And
the remove personal, you mean?
Yeah.
Because it directly relates to financial investments, that section.
That, Senator Seekins, that's certainly true in B, subsection B. And I think I even was the one who suggested that.
Right.
But only with respect to... It was, right. But it was only with respect to B, not A.
Okay.
And I recommend you leave personal or
in A
in there. Yeah.
Okay.
Because maybe divestiture isn't quite the right word, but what we can have is a situation sometimes where people are on a board, for example,
right.
And if they resign from that board, and that's a personal type interest.
Madam Clerk, have we passed an amendment yet? We haven't really made them. Okay, so this would be amendment 2, which went away. So this would be number 3, or would we use number 2? There was, well, do you still hold on to your conceptual amendment? It was withdrawn, right? Amendment 2 is withdrawn. This would be 3, amendment number 3. So the chair would, as amendment number 3, reinsert the words personal or on line 2 of page 4. Is there objection?
Say that again, please.
Chair, the motion is to reinsert the words personal or, which in this version are stricken or are deleted. The bracketed words personal or, we would leave those in the bill.
And then just make the conforming changes to make it plural. Did you make amendment number 2?
We withdrew it, so it still stands.
Oh,
there.
I see. Withdrew it. Okay.
Senator Guess.
Not on this amendment, but what we did in the past.
What did we do wrong? Tell me, and we'll correct it.
No, I thought we had put in on page 2, line 3, the after ethics supervisor.
We had not. We can still look at that.
Oh, okay. I thought we had.
I'd talked about it, but I didn't move it as an amendment. I don't believe. No. Senator Terrio.
So, Mr. Chairman, on page 4, putting the personal or back in, I asked you to restate it. I don't know if we finalized.
Divestor or removal of, by the employee of the personal or financial interests. So that would read section A, subparagraph A would read the divestiture or removal by the employee of the personal or financial interest that gives rise to the potential violation. Or then we would.
That would just allow a designated ethics supervisor to require someone to...
Restate it, clarify it, now let's close it. Close the deal here.
Right.
Okay.
Right. So that's amendment number 3. Is there any objection to amendment number 3? Hearing none, it's adopted. You're right. Let's go. Amendment of section 9. This all deals with the section 9, section 10... All deal with the 11. All number 12.
Mr. Chairman.
And number 13, is it? All deal with the process that we have for the Attorney General, Lieutenant Governor, and Governor. Are there any proposed amendments to these sections dealing with that process? Senator French.
The concerns I have regarding Section 10 all relate to the same review of the report of the independent